right. That's exactly what I need to be jumping up and down and getting the energy flowing today. And I'm really excited to be here. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a really interesting show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Lynn Washington Jr., a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and a columnist for the ThisCan'tBeHappening.net site. And we're going to be talking about, in addition to the police killing black people, there's a whole other realm of dehumanization that takes place through the actions of the police. And we're going to be talking about that for a bit, what's going on in Philadelphia. Before that, we are going to be joined by, and this is very, very, very serious, we are going to be joined by Gada Morad, who is the sister of Firas Morad, who was shot and killed by the police in the California city of Long Beach on May 27th. And we're going to be talking about who her brother was, what happened, what really happened, what she's thinking about it, and the movement that's building up around this, all right? And opening the show up, we'll be talking with journalist Larry Everest. Larry is a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. And Larry joins us to talk about the major developments breaking out across the Middle East and how we should understand them and why it's important to understand them. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be with you, Michael.
Yeah, I've been waiting to talk with you for some time now, man, because as you're looking at the Middle East, I think anybody who's taking a look at the Middle East in any way, shape, or form has to be really puzzled, upset, searching for an understanding of what the hell is going on there. There's all kinds of wars. There's people fighting back and forth. There's new forces emerging. What's happening there right now?
Well, I think the best way to understand it is in three different dimensions. The first is the whole framework of imperialist domination, which has lasted over a century in the Middle East, is really cracking apart. And that's evident from Libya to Egypt to the situation in Syria, certainly, Yemen, Iraq, and even more broadly in the region. And, you know, one of the things that really bothers me is when people look at the Middle East and think, oh, it's always been a mess. People have always just been fighting against each other. No, not true. Yes, for many centuries, like in many parts of the world, there have been oppressive feudal and tribal societies. But it was British and French imperialism and now U.S. imperialism that have really made this region what it is today. They were the ones that drew borders, like in Iraq, in Syria, Palestine, and Israel. They were the ones that created states that brought these various military dictators, as in Egypt, tyrants like the religious fanatics in Saudi Arabia, people like the Shah of Iran. They were the ones that put them in power. And for the last 70 years, it's been the U.S. that's really been shaping the region politically, economically, and socially, and doing so with violence, incredible violence, including 500,000 children killed in Iraq. There was just a study out by this International Society for the Prevention of Nuclear War in which they found that 1.3 million people had just been killed or died as a result of the wars the U.S. started in 2001, 1.3 million people in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. And so this whole order of very oppressive, very suffocating political rulers, tremendous oppression, these torture regimes, and also the great distortion of this region to be an oil producer and spigot, a transit point for imperialism, which has created so much suffering for the people there, is beginning to crack apart. And all of this is a real exposure. If you step back and draw the lens back, you know, the U.S. Media and the U.S. government are constantly pointing a finger at blaming the Iraqis, blaming the Syrians, blaming the people in Yemen. And I'm not upholding the political forces in those countries that are in the ruling class or particularly the reactionary fundamentalists that have a lot of initiative in those countries now. But look, overall, it's the United States and the other imperialist powers that are responsible for this horrific situation. I mean, right now, Michael, in Yemen, to take one example, two out of three of the children in Yemen, 2 million children, have their growth stunted by hunger. And right now, the U.S., this isn't a thing of the past. Right now, the U.S. is backing a Saudi blockade, which has meant that nearly 80% of Yemen's people, 20 million people, need humanitarian relief because the Saudis, with U.S. backing, with U.S. airplanes, with U.S. cluster bombs, with U.S. technicians making sure those airplanes fly, with U.S. intelligence directing where they go, has imposed a blockade where they're preventing food and medicine and other vital supplies from even getting in there. And Yemen is a country that imports 90% of its food. So the U.S. and the Saudis are starving an already starving country. So when you look at the Middle East, think about the bankruptcy of this promise and this claim that the United States brings liberation, that it brings democracy, that it brings freedom to these different areas. And the fact that all this is breaking down right now, all these pent-up contradictions and pent-up rage are exploding now, is an indictment of that whole 100 years, and in particular the last 70 years, in which the U.S., with client regimes and allies like Israel and the tyrant Mubarak and the torture regime in Saudi Arabia, where beheading is a legal form of capital punishment, have inflicted so much suffering. And all this is flying apart right now.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. All right, Larry, well, let's dig into what you've just been talking about, because, you know, this region is in such amount of upheaval that it's astonishing to a lot of people who've looked at this over the years and thought, well, everything's sort of rock steady for the U.S. there. You know, they get in little fights here and there, a little tension builds up. But the kind of things that we're seeing now, it's just like somebody just took the table and just turned it over on its side, and everything seems to be up for grabs right now. Let's talk about what's behind some of this, what actually the situation is. Like, what is it? What's happening with Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think, you're right, Michael. It is sort of a stunning escalation of the amount of upheaval and chaos there. And if we look overall, and I want to dig into this, is one trigger for this. I mentioned sort of the longer-term suffering and contradictions. I mean, in terms of Saudi Arabia, you're talking about an absolute monarchy run by, I think it's 1,000-plus princes. This is an absolute monarchy that's based on very vicious repression and an extremely reactionary understanding and variant of Islam. And I would say there are really two main triggers for what's happening right now. One is the fact that the United States went in to this region in 2001 and launched the so-called War on Terror. And this was an attempt to really crush all the forces that were in the way of the U.S., including the Islamic jihadists, and really restructure this area and turn it into, you know, there were a number of dimensions of this. I document this in my book. But basically a platform for, to turn this whole region into a platform for U.S. imperialism globally, militarily, economically, in terms of control of energy. And it would be a weapon against rising challengers like Russia and China. And, of course, now we can see those conflicts are escalating greatly. But instead of, you know, especially with the invasion of Iraq, instead of turning Iraq into this kind of a platform into the region and weakening Iran and taking down, I think they had a list of 7 states they were planning to take down in the first 5 years of this war on terror. Instead of doing that, the U.S. failed, A, to create any kind of a stable regime in Iraq, B, it sparked a massive hatred and opposition for the crimes that it's committed. And number three, it's tremendously given an opening and fueled reactionary jihadism and Islamic fundamentalism, which is what we see taking place right now in western and northern Iraq and eastern and northern Syria in particular with ISIS. Now, this has reverberated profoundly in a country like Saudi Arabia for a number of different reasons. For example, one of the impacts of overthrowing the Saddam Hussein regime has been to strengthen, in certain ways, the reach of Iran. Iran has much more influence in Iraq. It has growing influence in Syria, in Lebanon, also to some degree in Yemen and Palestine even. And this has sparked a regional rivalry between the reactionary Shia Islam-based regime in Tehran, in Iran, and the Saudis, the Sunni-based reactionary religious fundamentalist regime there. And there's been this is a lot of what is taking place in Syria is really in many ways a regional proxy war where forces like Turkey, Israel, Saudi Arabia are funding the jihadists in many cases in order to knock down the Assad regime and weaken Iran. This is also one of the things that has led the Saudis to launch this vicious bombing assault on the people of Yemen, because there again, there's a state where the U.S., Ali Abdusalah, a U.S.-backed tyrant ruled that country with an iron fist for decades. He's overthrown in 2011-2012 as a result of the Arab Spring. And there's been a slow boiling civil war, which really escalated last year when the Houthis, which, you know, they're a people living in northern Yemen, their religion, and this again is another religiously based opposition movement, is a derivative of Shia Islam. So the Saudis feel even if Iran isn't directly funding or directly arming the Houthis, that any gain by the Houthis would be a blow to Saudi stability, would increase the strength of Iran, and so on. So across the region, you see this, the traditional order of things coming unglued and all these rivalries escalating. And so one of the results, in other words, in basic terms, what did this the U.S. war on terror, the invasion of Iraq, succeed in doing? It cracked open the basic structure of power within this region, and out has boiled all these different contradictions between imperialism and Islamic fundamentalism, between reactionary states in the region. And one of the other things I want to say in terms of Saudi Arabia is that, look, the U.S. is in a tremendous pickle. I mean, this is demonstrating every day that these rulers are not at all powerful. They're in deep trouble here. They tried to go in with tens of thousands of troops to reshape Iraq. It didn't work. Now they're very hesitant to commit troops to Iraq again in any way, shape, or form, including because they're facing these other global challenges, including the escalating conflict in Ukraine between Russian imperialism on one side and the reactionary forces in Ukraine that it supports, and then, of course, this right-wing pro-West government in Kiev and the Western imperialists supporting them. So the U.S., And you know, none of the U.S. rulers are—they're really fumbling around trying to figure out how to deal with all this. But one of the ways they are seeking to deal with it is to cut a deal with Iran And part of the reasoning for that is, number one, they want to take the nuclear, even the potential that Iran could be a nuclear state and have even the capacity to appear to have the capacity to produce nuclear weapons would change the military balance in the region. So the U.S., A, wants to take that off the table, and B, I think they want to enlist Iran, or certainly play it off against the Sunni jihadists in the region, and use sort of a tacit alliance with Iran to try to get control of this whole situation. And then the potential for a nuclear deal with Iran, that the Saudis see this as a huge problem, because it could end up strengthening Iran. It could further tilt the balance of power in the region toward Iran. It could legitimize Iran. And this is something that the Saudis and the U.S. Rulers have been openly in conflict about. The new Saudi king wouldn't even come to Washington in May for a U.S. summit that he had previously promised to come to. So this was an open snub of the U.S. because of these deep differences, precisely because these contradictions are intractable for the U.S. and its allies and the other oppressive regimes in the region.
All right, let me ask you this. Larry, first, let me tell people, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper. Now, Larry, let's talk about this, because this is a fairly heavy situation for the U.S. when you have an age-old ally like Saudi Arabia, you know, having all these contradictions, you know, and you have other countries, like they've lost Egypt to a certain extent. They don't have that, not lost it completely, but they lost their mainstay there, their whole pillar of strength there when they got rid of Mubarak. What's happening? I mean, this is all a very serious contradiction for the U.S., it would seem, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely it is, because let's not, and I just want to say here that these are issues we go into in much greater depth. I know I'm writing on this, and other revolution writers are writing, and people can see this at revcom.us. I've recently written on the Iran, Saudi Arabia, so if listeners want to get into more depth, they can go to revcom.us. But look, it is a very serious thing, because the Middle East, since World War II, has been a key pillar of U.S. imperialist dominance. It's up until this point, and the energy map globally is shifting somewhat. But the U.S. Historically, 60% of the world's oil reserves have been in the Middle East, and control of this resource has been a key strategic weapon of empire against all countries that depended on oil, either to import oil or to sell oil. This is one reason that Saudi Arabia now has forced the price so low, is to punish Iran and Russia, who depend on oil sales, for a large percentage of their foreign earnings and their budget. It's also been a key trade and military crossroads worldwide. So this region, and look, this is why it's funded Israel and supported the ethnic cleansing of Palestine by Israel, because Israel is its unsinkable military outpost with Israel's own interests and agenda as well, but nonetheless a key military outpost for the U.S. in the region. And this is why, not because of the Israel lobby in the U.S., but because of the key role Israel plays in this key region of the world. So this coming apart is a huge problem for them. But it's also led to a horrific situation for the people, because what we're seeing in much of this region is the clash of the force rising to fight against these pro-imperialist regimes has been really horrific, barbaric, reactionary fundamentalist groups like Al-Qaeda, like Al-Nusra, like the Islamic States. I mean, people are being, religious minorities are being driven out of their homes, or many are being killed, women really medieval forms of the suppression of women are being violently enforced. These forces have nothing whatsoever positive to offer humanity.
All right, let me ask you this, Larry. First, let me tell people, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper. I do want to, you know, I want to dig into this ISIS question, because this is one of the, you know, most dynamic questions when people are looking at the Middle East right now, and they're thinking, holy, what's going on? And they see this group out there, and it appears to be just barreling over everything else that's in place there, causing all kinds of trouble. And it seems to be, you know, it's getting this sort of just eyesight analysis, this idea of like, well, it's this grassroots group that grew up and it certainly can't be smashed by imperialism. It just keeps growing and spreading. Let's talk about ISIS, what it's doing, where it comes from, and what it's about.
Well, as I said, I mean, it's about violently enforcing a very fundamentalist version of Sunni Islam. And, you know, basically imposing an extremely harsh theocratic rule, which is, you know, it's particularly pronounced in terms of the oppression of women. But I think in terms of the spread of ISIS, again, I think we have to look at several things. Number one, without a revolutionary pole, a revolutionary communist pole that offers a liberating way out for people, many, many, many thousands of people who have been oppressed either directly by U.S., suffered directly under U.S. bombs or drone strikes, or at the hands of U.S.-backed regimes, are going to turn to whatever force is there that seems to be fighting against the people tormenting them. This is what happened in Iraq. The U.S. imposed a repressive Sunni sectarian organizations as the new government of Iraq and systematically excluded, persecuted, and murdered the Sunni population. So it's not surprising that the Sunnis are either tacitly allowing or outright supporting a group like ISIS. The other thing that's contributed to its rise is the rottenness and the weakness of the regimes in the region, regimes like the Assad regime in Syria and the regime that now exists in Iraq, the Iraqi government. You know, there's a lot of rot there that's exposed by this war. And then finally, there is the issue of ISIS and other of these jihadist forces being funded by different states or wealthy, prominent members of the ruling classes in these different states. You know, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, other Gulf states, as well as Turkey, and them doing that for their own regional agenda. But I think that the key for people to really understand is supporting either of these outmoded forces. To the degree that people sit in the U.S. and think, oh my, ISIS is horrible. Yes, they are horrible. But to the degree you're passively supporting the United States, and if you're not actively opposing the U.S., it's a big green light for the imperialists here to try to figure out what sort of violence they're going to uncork. And they are. They may not be sending ground troops in there, but people should be clear. They're waging war in Iraq and Syria right now via drones and bombing campaigns, hundreds of them. To the degree people are just passive, they're actually ending up helping fuel reactionary Islamic fundamentalism. So it's really important for people in this country to oppose the crimes of this government. Let's not forget, how did we get to the place we are today? We got to the place we are today because of the crimes this government has committed for decades, but particularly in the last 14 years, against the people of the region and the crimes of states like Israel that's supporting every day. That is what's created the the fuel, so to speak, for these reactionary, for these fundamentalists who are horrific. So in terms of the other thing that I think is crucial for breaking this horrific dynamic, that there's just, look, there over 10 million people in Syria have been driven from their homes. Over 200,000 have been killed. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. But one of the other things that's so important in terms of creating a different pole and a different alternative for people that really does offer a way out is promoting communism, the beginning of a new stage, a manifesto from the Revolutionary Communist Party. And this is very important because it's the theoretical framework for a new wave of liberating revolution. And that, and people across the region are hungry for a way out. And this, and they have to understand that there is one. And this is a very important document to spread at this moment. It's in seven languages, including Arabic, Farsi, and Turkish. The other thing is to promote revolution newspaper. Right now, people from 166 countries around the world go to revcom.us and supporting and spreading and circulating the newspaper is another extremely important way to fight for this revolutionary pole so that we can break out of this terrible dynamic that is really, it's taking the region deeper and deeper into hell.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Larry Everest, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq, and the U.S. Global Agenda. Well, let me ask you this. This will be our final question, and we're going to have about maybe 3 minutes to answer it. You know, we've talked before about how complex this all is, what it sort of indicates, what it hints at in terms of, and also where it comes from in a very heavy way. But it also indicates and hints at, and you've done this a lot and when you speak, it's sort of this whole question of these events reverberating and could reverberate even more powerfully and be part of a mix for a revolutionary opening in the U.S. and in other countries around the world. Let's talk about that for about 3 minutes.
Well, that's really important because, first of all, a lot of times you'll say revolution and people think, oh, it's impossible. The rulers are all powerful. Well, what's going on in the Middle East shows they are not. The second thing is that, you know, events in the Middle East can reverberate in many different ways in terms of struggles in the ruling class. They can reverberate in economic ups and downs and shock waves that go around the world. I mean, I can't even imagine the impact of the collapse of the regime in Saudi Arabia. I mean, this would be a geopolitical earthquake if something like this happened. They raise tremendous ideological questions within this country about the illegitimacy and the of the rulers of this country. So all of this can come together with other contradictions that are boiling, like we see around the issue of just this epidemic, this relentless epidemic of the murder and brutality against black people and other Latinos, other people of color that's going on in this country, the vicious outright assault on women, as we were talking about this decision that was just rendered in Texas that will effectively close many abortion clinics. All these things can come together in a real crisis, in a real revolutionary crisis and possibility for making an actual revolution, but that's only going to happen if people are working now to really prepare the ground, prepare the people, and prepare the leadership for such a time and really bring forward an alternative. I mean, just in this, I thought it was very significant, and I know you've played this game, but this dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West, Revolution and Religion, that took place last year is a tremendous resource in terms of helping people understand how we could really get out of mm-hmm. the horror. And let's not forget, Michael, that a revolution in this country, I mean, one of our duties has to be to make revolution in this country at the absolute soonest possible moment, because this country is more responsible than any other power in the world for the devastation of the climate, global exploitation, and this horrific violence we see anywhere we turn. And a revolution here and bringing to power a new revolutionary liberating state would just have enormous repercussions globally.
All right, and on that note, we're going to have to stop because we've just run out of time. But thank you very much for joining us today, Larry.
Oh, you're welcome, Michael. Thank you.
Okay, man. Take care. Talk to you later. All right. We've been talking with Larry Everest about the very explosive situation in the Middle East and how we should look at it and understand it, and on that basis, what we should do about it. Larry's a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, and he's also the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Killing Fields from Last Internationale. And talking about the killing fields, check this out. At least 485 people have been killed by U.S. police since January 1st, 2015. That's according to a study done by the Washington Post. At least 1,104 were killed in 2014, and at least 2,359 have been killed since May 1st, 2013. All right, now you think about this. When we're talking about this 485 people who have been killed since January of this year, we're talking two a day, sisters and brothers, two a day. And that's only people who have been shot by the police, killed by the police, shot by the police. You know, people who've been killed by being shot. What about the people like Freddie Gray? What about the people who have been beaten to death, who somehow mysteriously did something? Like they used to say in South Africa when they put the black people up in jail in South Africa, they said, oh, he died. He slipped on a bar of soap and fell out the window. He slipped on a bar of soap and his head went into a noose. We're talking about wholesale murder of a whole group of people. And recently, a really horrific case has come to light. And that's on May 27th. A young man named Faris Marad was murdered by the police in Long Beach, California. And here to talk with us about that is Gada Marad, his sister. Gada, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us what happened to Faraz?
Well, on May 27, 2015, he was shot and killed by the police. He was on shrooms, but I'm not going to say that was a bad thing because, I mean, he's a 20-year-old boy. It's not like it's like an abnormal thing. A lot of kids have done drugs in college and high school. And they've done shrooms, you know, it's not like a huge deal. And his body didn't react well to it. And he jumped out a window and he was bleeding from head to toe. And the police officers just decided to shoot him instead of trying like other ways to like make him like stop, like, I don't know, acting the way he did. He wasn't even acting violent. I know that he had his hands up. He was bleeding from head to toe. And they shot him four times. And I found out on Friday by messaging his friend because he wasn't answering the phone. And his friend told me to call him, and I was in my first period class. And I found out through the phone, and I had to tell both of my parents. And that's not the way that your parents are supposed to find out that their son died. And that's not the way I'm supposed to find out. That's a lot of pressure on a 16-year-old girl in high school. And she was physically in her high school in her first period class. It was 8:15 in the morning. That's not a nice way to wake up.
Oh, absolutely. It's horrific. And those gangsters, the official law enforcement gangsters, actually did not tell your family that they had murdered your brother until days later? Or did they ever tell your family?
Even after I found out that day they didn't call us, the coroner's office ended up calling us way later. Not even 3 days. He died on Wednesday, and I found out on Friday morning. Nobody called us.
You know, it's believable. It's disgusting. It's repulsive. It's believable, given what we're dealing with. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you, you've made a statement that said, and it was a very moving statement, you said, it's absolutely ridiculous that my brother is gone. I don't know how this happened. And you said, I don't know how this could have happened to someone like him. And then you made this, and I think it's really important to explore this a little. Even if he did something wrong, he should not have died. Let's talk about that. Can you explain to people what you meant? Even if he had done something wrong, he should not have died.
I'm saying that if he did something wrong, like if people believe that him taking shrooms was wrong, like even if he was not being violent for sure, but if he was, like, I don't know, walking a little too fast or even swinging his arms a little, they didn't have to shoot him. He was bleeding from head to toe. He didn't have his glasses. He can't see well. Bleeding from head to toe. He was obviously confused. He fell out of a two-story window. Obviously, he has, like, brain damage. He couldn't hurt anyone, you know? Like, even if he was swinging, they shouldn't have shot him. There are so many other things they could have done, you know? And it was one police officer that decided to kill him. This is not a decision that one person can make.
And it's very heavy because, you know, I'm reading what his friends had said at the time. And they said, people who said who saw the thing happening, they said they were shouting to the cop, "Don't shoot, don't shoot. He's not armed." And
he's
there's even, yeah. And even on the call, on the 911 call, there's actually the person they're talking to says, "No, I don't see any weapons."
Yeah, there's no weapons. He wasn't going to hurt anyone. It was impossible.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Gada Murad, who is the sister of Firas Murad, who was shot and killed by the Long Beach, California police on May 27th. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that happens is, like, it really is the situation in this kind of society, in another kind of society, the kind of society I want to see, you know, a cop, if they came to a scene like that, pardon me?
A cop is supposed to come and save someone.
Right. Well, that's in another kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They called 911 too, in order to save my brother, not to shoot him and kill him. That's ironic how the police is going to come and kill you, not come and save you now. Mm-hmm. Like, who are you going to call when you feel unsafe? You're not going to, I'm pretty sure people are going to second guess themselves next time they want to call the police. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely going to, like, try to find every alternative before I ever call the police. I'm definitely not going to. Hopefully not going to have the need to call the police ever in my life.
Right, exactly. And because that happens so many times when they come and they're somebody who's really distressed, who's injured, who needs help, no matter what they're doing, who needs help. And their choice, their first choice is kill them. You know, there was just a young woman in South Central last year that they went up and they tried to arrest her, and then they beat her up on the way down. They hogtied her, threw her in the back of the car, and she suffocated. These are the kinds of things. This was a woman who was paranoid and had a drug problem. And instead of taking care of someone, they killed them. You know, one of the things I wanted to read, too, is that there was a woman who watched the thing who said, and I think it was a woman, I'm not sure, but said, "His hands were in the air like this. He was unarmed. He had no shirt, no shoes. He was wounded, delirious. He was high on something. That child did not need to die. And I hope that the cop sees that kid's face for the rest of his life, because he is a murderer. I can't close my eyes without seeing him. I threw up.
Yeah.
I sobbed so much, the neighbors thought I knew the kid. I didn't know the kid. I just saw a child get murdered."
Yeah.
So, Gada, tell me this. You have a whole movement that's been built around this, that's shown up on Facebook, that's mobilizing thousands of people. You've had rallies. Tell me about that movement, how it formed, why people are standing up like this, and what they're doing.
Okay. Well, first off, people are definitely standing up for this because it's wrong, and this shouldn't be happening. Like, it shouldn't happen ever again. And another reason why people are there is because they know Firas. Like, majority of the people that are there know Firas. was a national speech and debate champion. He got accepted to Berkeley, UCLA. He knew everything about everything. He was so smart, and he had a lot of friends, and they're all there to support him. You know, it's not like he was like some bad kid who, like, even if he was a bad kid, they're not supposed to kill him. You know.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Absolutely. Now, this movement on Facebook, a lot of people have been posting all kinds of things in support of Firas.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that a little?
About the people who are supporting Firas?
Yeah, and the kind of movement that you're building, what you're doing.
We're trying to raise awareness for this, because police officers, there are good police officers, definitely. I'm sure most of them are good. But there is a certain amount of police officers that don't know what they're doing. And people have to know that just because, like, they're a police officer doesn't mean, someone yesterday said, it doesn't mean there's a halo over their head. Like, just because they're a police officer, they're there to protect us. You know, that's actually being, like, stereotypical. Oh, a police officer's always supposed to protect us. No, at the end of the day, they're a human being and they can make mistakes.
But you know what, got it? You know what the big thing is to remember on that? The big thing to remember is that thing I read in the beginning of this, that 845 people at least have been killed by U.S. police since January of this year. You know, that what cops are here to do is to enforce a very barbaric system. That cop that killed your brother, when you look at him, he's actually saying, he was actually saying from the very beginning, in his head was, this guy is going down. Even if he says I was freaking, I was whatever, He was saying he knew that he wasn't armed. He knew he was in tremendous distress. He was bleeding. He had no idea where he was going. And as you pointed out, he didn't even have his glasses. What are we talking about here? This is somebody who, yes, should be given help. And this is not what they do. Now, you know, this movement that you developed, this movement, which I think you had a vigil the other night that drew out hundreds of people. Did you have an action yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday there was a rally.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
There's a lot of people there. I'm not sure how many. It was either like 100 or over 100 or a little less. I'm not sure. But there was even people on the street, strangers that joined us. We went in front of the Long Beach Police Department, the building, and we spoke to them on a microphone. And we just, you know, we chanted like all the way through, and we let more people know what happened.
Mm-hmm.
I met people who have lost family from...
From what? We've lost you for a minute. You met people who had families from what?
I met people who have family members who have been murdered by the police.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How was that? That must have... Did that, like, kind
it,
of...
It made me a little comforted, because I met a girl who lost her... He was shot in the head, and he was unarmed as well.
Yeah. God, I want to ask you... one more question. The Facebook, how do people find you on Facebook? How do they get in touch with you?
Well, my name is Gada Morad on Facebook. It's GHADAMORAD. Mm-hmm. And if they have any questions, they can ask. I'll try to get to them.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a page on Facebook that's called Justice for Firas Morad. It's, everyone knows how to spell Justice for, and his name is spelled FERASMORAD. If you look up his name on the internet, it'll come up.
Okay.
There's articles, there's everything, you know, but there are articles that are lying about it, so I suggest that they go to the Justice for Firas page on Facebook, and they can message me if they want.
Mm-hmm. All right, Gada, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and stay strong, sister. I really am, and keep in touch. Let us know how this develops, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Once again, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Gada Morad, who's the sister of Firas Morad, who was executed by the Long Beach Police, a champion debater, a young guy, 20 years old, who went into, and, you know, his girlfriend, who was his girlfriend for 5 years, she's 20, she was his girlfriend since she was 15, she talked about who he was and how he lived. And she talked about how he cared for people. When he would see people in distress, people hungry, he would stop and help them. When he would see animals that needed help, he would stop and help them. This is a young guy who was, you know, his big thing was being a debater. And I'll tell you what, you know, he did this thing that went out and sort of a lot of the stuff that the system says, hey, this is somebody that should, you know, this is somebody that's like really doing good. A champion debater. He was in ROTC, okay? He was he got accepted to Berkeley and UCLA and chose to go to Moorpark College, and he was planning on transferring to Cal State Long Beach for money reasons. But he wanted to go to Harvard and be a lawyer. And where did he end up? Dead in the street, shot down by a murdering cop. Never, ever forget that, all right? We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was The Last Internationale with their song Moaning at Midnight. Joining us now to talk about another question around the police, around police brutality, what's been going on. I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Lynn Washington. Now, Lynn's a journalist. He's a journalist based in Philadelphia. He's an investigative journalist, columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, a founder of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, and a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. He's also been covering the Mumia Abu-Jamal stories from the very beginning and doing a hell of a very intensely good job around it. And he's joining us now to talk about an article he wrote recently called Tasing and Bust a Videotaper Shows Abuse of Blacks is Not Just Normal Cop Behavior. Lynn, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for having me on the show today.
Sure, I'm good, man. Well, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, you know, as I'm reading your piece, and the first thing that struck me is that what you lay out really does indicate something that I've seen so many times and it put it together very well, I thought. You know, this idea that, yes, there's a lot of police killings, as I've been saying, that just the you know, whatever the number it was, the hundreds, the 400 or so, 385 people who've been killed in the U.S. just by cops shooting them, and then the others that have been killed by slipping on a bar of soap, supposedly, or whatever, you know, and referring to South Africa again. But this whole point about there's a certain amount of dehumanization that has to accompany that in order to allow this stuff to go on. And you make a point that it's not just being killed by the police, but there's a whole other level of indignities and dehumanization that goes on. Let's talk about that.
You characterized correctly what I was attempting to do with the piece, so I guess I was effective in my writing. But I wanted to show that while fatal police shootings and other fatal encounters with police are absolutely outrageous, it's the smaller abuses and indignities that happen thousands and thousands of times a day that create the rage that, like you saw exploding in Baltimore when the rebellion took place there a couple of weeks ago. Yes, Freddie Gray became a flashpoint. Months before that, there was a gentleman who was taken to a hospital. He was mentally ill. He was unruly in the hospital. Policemen were called. They tasered this guy six times in the hospital, in addition to choking him and beating him in the hospital emergency room. And then that was cleared off because the prosecutors claimed that it wasn't the fact that he was shot with a taser six times or choked or beaten. It was the fact that he had meningitis and he died from meningitis. So what I was trying to bring forward is these day-to-day insults. And that is what the system, as you correctly know, is rotten. But that's the types of things that the system all but condones and acquiesces to. And then that creates the climate where a police officer could come. And as I heard with your previous call on your previous topic, where the guy just comes in and shoots a man. And it claims that he was in fear of his life. If police officers have that type of visceral fear, then they shouldn't be a police officer. If you want to be a brain surgeon, but you have a problem with seeing blood, you have no business being a brain surgeon. Regardless of your intellect, your surgical capabilities, and your fine hands, if you get freaked out by blood and you see blood, you can mess up. So, you know, being a police officer doesn't mean it's a job for life. You got to be able to do the job and do it well. And if you're not capable mentally or emotionally of doing it, and it's a very dangerous job at times, you need to give it up.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Lynn Washington Jr. Lynn is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist, columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, and a founder of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net.
You know, one thing I was thinking, though, in relation to that, and because I know we're on limited time, so I really want to move through this, but one thing I was thinking is something I was just talking with Gada about as well. You know, when you literally look at it, the job of the police in society, I firmly believe that the job of the police is to actually do the kind of stuff that they're doing, which is to keep order in the society. And that means mainly, you know, kicking the ass of the mainly oppressed people, but really carrying out this kind of stuff. What will be done will be done. If you're sick, you'll get killed. You know, if you're Freddie Gray, you'll get hogtied and thrown in the back of a van and ridden all over Baltimore until your neck snaps or whatever. And you make a point in relation to that I thought was really interesting. You say abuses by police often arise from deliberate police practices, which is a pretty heavy thing when you think about it.
Yeah, well, the article that I wrote, I used the occasion to really examine, get inside of one very outrageous but quite regular and routine police abuse. In Philadelphia, as in a number of other cities, there are very specific regulations, and in this instance, issued by the police commissioner, that citizens are allowed to videotape police officers as long as this videotaping or photographing in no way interferes with the police enforcement action. And what we have in Philadelphia is serial violations of that policy by police. So in this particular instance, there was a group of guys on the corner, two police officers who were on community patrol, walk by, some words are exchanged, and the eyewitnesses said the police used some expletives, you know, get off this corner, move this bicycle, a bicycle that wasn't even blocking the sidewalk. The police officers left, and then they came back with about a dozen others, and then they just started beating heads. This particular gentleman, Sharif Anderson, was videotaping it. The police officers left the sidewalk, went up on someone's property, up on their porch, grabbed the guy, beat him, kicked him, and tasered him not once, but twice. Then they arrested him, Mr. Anderson, charged him with assault on a police officer when he was the one that was assaulted, resisting arrest and disorderly conduct. This happened 2 years ago. He still hasn't come to trial. He has an arrest record hanging over his head. He can't get a new job because of the arrest record. He's paid out thousands of dollars in legal representation. The police officers don't show up at trial, so the trial gets postponed. And this is the type of thing that goes on and on and on. What was interesting about this, there was an internal affairs investigation. And the internal affairs investigation, it reads like a comic book, really. Because here you have the police officers saying, well, no, we didn't curse at anybody. We politely asked them to move the bicycle and move along. And then they started taunting us. Now, think about this for a minute. Here's an armed police officer who you know is itching for some trouble. And you're going to get up in his face and tell him, you know, take off your badge, I'm going to punch you. And that's just ridiculous. I covered a situation maybe about 7 years ago where some protesters were on a demonstration where they were protesting the police killing of a man, where some narcotics officers came up on this guy, thought that he was a drug dealer, thought that he swallowed some drugs, so they were choking him to make him cough up the drugs. So he died. Murder? Yes, it was. But that was just brushed aside. So a few days later, some people were out protesting, and the police officer's version is that they came up, asked the people to leave the intersection, and one of the guys said, I'm not leaving the intersection. If you want me to leave, you're going to have to shoot and kill me. Can you imagine anybody who is not insane, rationally telling the police that I'm not moving unless you shoot and kill me? That's just ridiculous. But these are the types of stories that the police officers tell. Internal Affairs accepts it. prosecutors accept it and judges accept it. That's where, as you rightfully know, this system is rotten to the core. I've increasingly come to say that it's not just a few rotten apples. That's what you hear about, you know, police brutality. Those are a few rotten apples. No, this is not only a few rotten trees that have these rotten apples on it. It's a whole rotten apple orchard. Mm-hmm. And that's what the problem we have across the United States.
Exactly. Lynn, on that note, I'm going to have to bid you farewell, but I'll have you back again real soon, man. Always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you, man. Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with journalist Lynn Washington Jr. He's a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist, columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, a founder of ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, where you can find his work, by the way, as well the work of Dave Lindorf and other people. And he's a contributor to Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. And he's been talking about his recent article, It's Not Just Police Killings. All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show, and it's The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Larry Everest, Gada Murad, and Lynn Washington. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Federico Garcia. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And we're going to go out now with one more song from The Last Internationale. And this song is We Will Reign. All right, so check this out.